Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Grays Lake, Illinois, as usual. And I'm very pleased to have on the program a guest who's been on many, many times, one of my former elders back in the days of Calvary OPC in Glenside when I came into the OPC. We have with us Dr. Daryl Hart, who is Distinguished Associate Professor of History at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. Welcome back, Daryl. So good to see you.
Thanks. Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. I'd have you on every week if we could. We're thankful to have you. We know you're doing quite a bit of podcasting. We were just talking about some of your other programs, so the Paleo Protestant podcast, which you do with colleagues from Hillsdale, which is always enlightening, as well as a podcast with Dr. Crawford Gribben, who's been a guest on the program before, doing a podcast on religious nationalism. That's a little bit more up the alley here with this particular book we're going to be speaking about today. So we'll put links to those programs in the episode description, and I'm sure that you'll get around. Do you have any interesting episodes coming up soon on those programs? Or
I think we might get personal on the Paleo Protestant podcast and talk about our conversion narratives, if we have any, to these different traditions. I mean, Crawford and I, we didn't really get to the Protestant side of nationalism after our last one, which was his. I don't know if you've had him on about his book on Christian Ireland.
No, not yet. We talked about Reconstruction in the Pacific Northwest, a phenomenal episode.
Right. No.
And not because of us, but because of him. And it's a tremendous book. So we'd love to have him back.
It is. So that's the one we'd like to compare notes about, that and the experience of Protestants. But we were most recently comparing notes about Roman Catholics in Ireland and the U.S. and the forms that nationalism takes in those settings.
Sure.
So there's just not one size fits all for even any, certainly not any Protestant group. But then when it comes to Roman Catholics, when you think there'd be greater order and uniformity, but the local context matters so much, which became really apparent to me in working on this book as well.
Well, I'm glad you say that. That's been my experience as well. You're coming at things from an historical perspective, which I'm very thankful for. I've studied Roman Catholicism for several years, even in my doctoral program, but coming at it from a theological perspective. So to see the intersection, particularly in this historical era of which we're going to speak today, which leads up into Vatican II and then the years following, I learned a lot. Today we're going to be speaking about American Catholic, the Politics of Faith During the Cold War, by D.G. Hart, a guest today. And it is published by Cornell University Press, and it's published in the series Religion and American Public Life, which is edited, the series editors are Lawrence Moore and Daryl himself. So, Daryl, thanks so much for writing this book and editing the series. We're looking forward to future volumes down the road and whatever may come of that. But thanks for taking the time to speak about this today. It's really, really going to be interesting.
Sure. I mean, it's been a year since the book came out, and President Biden keeps an interest in the topic, even though he doesn't really come up in the book per se. And I was hoping that commentators on contemporary church and politics or the presidency would bring the book up, but it hasn't happened as much as I'd like, but that's okay. I mean, I learned a lot from it, and it's given me categories to write about Roman Catholics in America too, which is really a significant part of American history.
Yeah, it is. You need to be writing. See, the marketing brain, the portion of my brain would say, if you really wanted to pump this book or a book, you need to find a Roman Catholic who has a very powerful political talk show, and you need to write a chapter about them.
Right.
Or the enemy of somebody with a strong media presence. And then you get them and pump the book, and then you get all the Amazon juice going and all that stuff. So unfortunately, here talking about Catholics during the Cold War, it might be a little bit more challenging, but it's no less applicable and important. And it's helpful, I think, for people in the present, where Biden's Catholicism is certainly not, I mean, it is front and center in one respect. I just saw a headline today And given when this may air, just might be a week or two out of date, where the Pope said he still should take communion.
Right, I saw that too.
But the idea of that being an issue, you know, is usually not front and center on people's minds, whereas it was a tremendous question of whether a Roman Catholic could ever be president back in 1960.
Yeah, we have a lot of Roman Catholic students here at the college, and they have Protestants as well, younger kids. They just have no reference for the kind of antagonism between Protestants and Roman Catholics all the way down at least to 1970 as well. I mean, Kennedy broke through that considerably. And Vatican II obviously helped a lot. John Paul II, though, made it even more, made Rome a lot more attractive to say to Protestants, especially mainline Protestants who were looking for more substance. But to go back to the days of even when Americanism, which is a topic in the book, it's hard to define, but put simply, it's the idea, it's sort of like modernism for Protestants. It's the idea that you adapt the church, particularly the structures of the church, to the American political landscape or American social conventions. So you know, you accommodate democracy in some way, you get greater lay involvement, and you also recognize the importance of religious freedom. That was deemed a heresy in 1899 by Leo XIII, in a very mild condemnation, the way I read that encyclical, which is very short. Americanism is all over the place now. It's the default position in the church in America, and there are people who are pushing back against it, Roman Catholics themselves, but students, young people, people who grow up, who were born after 1965, have no idea that that would be in any way objectionable. So, mm-hmm. You know, the book recovers some of that older Protestant Roman Catholic relationship.
Yeah, no, it's tremendous. It's interesting. In your interview with Al Mohler, which I thought was very insightful, Dr. Mohler made the comment that the question of Catholicism has come up with the second American president, Catholic president Joe Biden, but the question is, will he be Catholic enough for people? Whereas with President Kennedy, the question is, will he be Catholic? You know, that was the danger, whether he might follow the church's teachings. And now it's more where the conservatives are wanting the president to follow the church's teachings more because it might produce a better pragmatic result.
Well, and this is where I think, and maybe this is just because of the author myself writing about this, but I do say so many parallels between Protestants and Roman Catholics in the way that we approach American politics, especially in this sense that a big criticism among American conservatives who are most often Christian is that we need more religion in the public square. And yet, if you were to have a Presbyterian version of that or a Roman Catholic version of that, I think most people would say, no, I don't want that.
Right.
So really what they want more religion of is a generic Christianity that's ecumenical, interdenominational, largely moral, and maybe with some social teaching of the church, whether the Roman Catholic version, say, of subsidiarity, or you could work in the Kuyperian version of the sphere sovereignty and things like that. But, you know, but any kind of notion of a confessional state or an established church is just such a non-starter, mm-hmm. it seems to me. And that's, you know, so if you really wanted Biden to be more Roman Catholic, well, what would that mean? I tweeted out over the weekend, if Commonweal, the editors of Commonweal magazine, which I appreciate a lot, it's to the left of First Things, but they run a nice, say, buffet of articles on all sorts of topics, from church stuff to literature and poetry and politics in America and around the world as well. I mean, I think if those Roman Catholics were running some sort of religious establishment, I actually think most Protestants, Jews, Muslims, Mormons could get along with that,
Sure.
except people on the Roman Catholic right, or even probably some Protestants on the right. But
Yeah. So much of this has changed post 1967 with the Council, Vatican Council, Second Vatican Council, 62 to 67. And I'd also love to speak shortly about the theology and the influence of John Courtney Murray, different type of John Murray that we speak about often on Christ the Center. But even backing up a little bit, just to speak about this book and place it in a larger context of the literature, the historical literature at the time, I'm curious just about your thoughts on this book and your interest in writing it. I'm glad you have. But would most historians really expect the amount to exist covering the influence of Roman Catholicism on American politics? You might expect that there would be, a certain amount of them, but do you find that that's rather surprising? Are people's expectations met with the literature that's already out there?
that's a tough one.
Yeah.
I'm trying to go back into the literature and try to recall some of it. It has been a while, but and I do keep up with a lot of literature, at least, I mean, when I see reviews and whatnot and websites that I follow. I guess the polarization of the church along political lines is still really prominent. And I guess the excavations that historians are doing reflect those ideological differences. Not explicitly, but you can tell a kind of agenda that an author may have, whether coming down on one side or the other of Vatican II. But overall, I think the work of Roman Catholic historians themselves has been considerable. I mean, at publications like the American Catholic Historical Association, I can't remember the name of the journal, but it's
Yeah.
a really high-level journal. And then you also have the U.S. Catholic Historian, I think is the name, and there are just countless articles that I ran across in working on this book that were first rate, but oftentimes, because of the parochial nature of the church, which is something that it actually identified itself as in the 19th century, saying that it needed to step away from American life and set up parochial institutions, especially parochial schools. A lot of the literature on Roman Catholicism has been conducted by Roman Catholics themselves. And it's unfortunate because it really could show off in a wider setting. So that, say, for instance, a really good book that I didn't lean on greatly because it's a somewhat different story, but John McGreevy, who's a very fine historian at University of Notre Dame, and I think it's Catholicism and American Freedom. And it's a history of the way in which Roman Catholics have engaged with the idea of liberty and freedom in America. Just an exceptional, exceptional book, and it's published by Knopf. So it has there are these breakthrough books like this. I'm
Sure.
currently reading a book by the author's name will come back to me, but it's a history of American Catholicism, and it's published by Yale. And Harvard's been doing a lot of work of late on Roman Catholic, American Catholic subjects, very fine stuff. So I think we may be at the beginning where Roman Catholics are going to get their day in the sun,
Yeah.
and the presidency actually may make that even more possible. But I mean, one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about with changes among evangelical historians of late over the last 5 years after the election of Donald Trump, is the way in which evangelical scholarship about evangelicalism in America really did take off in the 80s. And even though historians weren't writing about evangelicals in politics, they were gaining a hearing precisely because the religious right was such a seemingly formidable force in American electoral politics.
Interesting.
So that editors, other scholars, pollsters, politicians wanted to know about this group. Who are they? And so you could argue that Reagan's America was a great context for flourishing of study of evangelicalism, and something similar could very well be happening now with President Biden, even though, you know, I think his ratings, I mean, not to get political anyway, but I mean, his ratings aren't the way Reagan's were, obviously, but still. So I don't know how that could color that kind of scholarship.
Well, it certainly seems to be the case that Protestants in the field will often study the effects of Protestantism on American politics. That's you know, not unusual. But what compelled you particularly and personally to study Roman Catholicism then, a subject that is often untreated by Protestant authors?
Well, having labored in conservative circles for the last almost 20 years now, I was at the Intercollegiate Studies Institute from 2003 to 2008. And one of my first, I think I write about this in the foreword, but I mean, I'm sorry, the preface, but one of my first encounters was with a Hillsdale student. We were at a soiree at Oriel College in Oxford, and we were taking our summer conferences to Oxford then, which was a great experience. So I'm having some champagne, I guess, and I'm meeting this undergraduate from Hillsdale who grew up Pentecostal, and she had just converted to Roman Catholicism. And I said, yeah, just sort of innocently, why would you do that? And I had my OP frame of mind on, and she said, well, everyone knows that to be a consistent conservative is to be a Roman Catholic. And it was, I mean, I had read a lot of conservative literature before that, not as much as I would later. And I was kind of aware of a Roman Catholic element in this. And by that point, say, Richard John Newhouse, who was someone I really enjoyed his writing, and I still subscribe to and read First Things faithfully, the magazine that he founded in 1990, I believe. He was still a Lutheran at that point, but he converted to Rome in roughly 1992. So anyway, I knew that there was this conservative world, conservative politics world out there, places like National Review, ISI, Hillsdale College. And here I am working at Hillsdale and teaching a curriculum in the core for history that leans a lot on the development of the ancient and medieval churches. And I can see how Roman Catholicism plays into the way American conservatives might think about America in relation to the West. So I figured I would go ahead and do this. I mean, it was partly just to try to figure out this world of conservatism in which that I am in, partly professionally. Not to say that Hillsdale is a Roman Catholic institution. It is not. We are now officially Christian, but we don't have any ecclesiastical ties. We have a huge and glorious chapel, $30 million worth of it. And it really is it's just a great facility. And Protestants and Roman Catholics both use it for different settings, different services. And I don't know how the college is going to sort all of this out. We have lots of devout faculty and students who come here on both sides of the Tiber. So anyway, that was the personal reason for trying to figure this out.
Sure.
Plus, I've been studying religion and politics in America for a while, and I'm also currently writing, and I've been working on this, overlapped a little bit with this book, on the study of Presbyterians in British politics, England, Scotland, Ireland, and eventually the New World. And Once you have certain political categories in view with the relationship of church and state, emperor and pope, king and bishop, you kind of have a working frame of reference to plug in other groups. So you get to America, and that, of course, that's very different from the British setting of ecclesiastical establishments. And so then you add Protestants and Roman Catholics who have experience with establishments coming to a disestablished world. So it's just really, for me, fascinating to see how different Christian groups embrace, stay aloof, try to set up different systems. So it's just part of that general historical interest, but also personal life experience.
Going back to that Hillsdale student you met in the mid-2000s, perhaps when you were over, for ISI in at Oxford. Do you think, I'm curious what she meant by, or this assumption, or this presupposition she had that to be a consistent conservative, you'd have to be Roman Catholic. Was she speaking about the fact that she was attempting to conserve something prior to the Reformation? Or was it the fact that so many of the thinkers of the conservative movement, like a Buckley and others, were Roman Catholic that seemed to be for Catholic reasons? Or both. Maybe it's all of the above, that some of their thinking is based on natural law arguments and other theology that is derived from a more ancient or medieval
Right.
context. Is it did was she operating at that level, or I'm curious
Right.
what her conversation partners were or what she intended by that comment.
My sense is that it's all the above, that there are these figures like Russell Kirk, who was a conservative actually before he became Roman Catholic. So there's that, and that's a little bit of a wrinkle in the mix. He wrote the famous best-selling book, The Conservative Mind, I believe in 1953. And I don't think he converted to Roman Catholicism until 1964. But he would be someone who is a staple here in certain history classes. We have a professorship in the history department named for Kirk. So that would be part of it, that people like Kirk and William F. Buckley, these Roman Catholics, were big parts of the conservative movement. It would also be, though, you mentioned natural law. I think pulling on the John Courtney Murray tradition of trying to locate the American founding in a natural law tradition. And even Richard John Neuhaus did this, I think, in the book, The Catholic Moment, published in the mid-80s, where I think he tried to say that the recovery of the American founding would rely needed, say, to recover a natural law tradition, and that Roman Catholics were in the best position to maintain that tradition as opposed to Protestants. And then on top of all that, I think this student may have been reflecting on her own study of literature, history, philosophy at Hillsdale, where you can see a debt that the modern era has to the medieval world and the ancient worlds, and even the American founding, the way we teach it here. You can see a debt to the ancient and medieval worlds, in addition to the pre-modern, early modern world of the Reformation. So again, it's not a neat, easy story of the way this plays out, and it's one of the reasons why I like to teach all this material, because you can isolate some of the arguments that are going on even within this development. But I could imagine her also putting these pieces together of the development of the West and how America comes out of that, as thinking, this is part of the way to keep this interest in and admiration for the American founding going, is by becoming Roman Catholic. But of course, as we were saying earlier, to any Protestant or even most Roman Catholics in the 1950s and even the 1960s, they'd be saying that doesn't make any sense that you would go to Roman Catholicism to keep alive the American political tradition. even John F. Kennedy, in his famous speech to the Baptist ministers in Houston in September of 1960, he makes a really smart play. And of course, he didn't write the speech himself alone. Ted Sorensen helped a lot with this, but he makes a really interesting play there to the Virginia Baptist tradition and the importance of separation in church and state. A lot of Baptists, obviously, in Texas. And this was a way of him appealing to that side of the American tradition of separation of church and state. And he will say in that speech that he believes in the absolute separation of church and state. I mean, it's something that is so foreign to the way that even President Biden is now covered by in places like the New York Times or the Washington Post or New Yorker magazine. I mean, they kind of celebrate his Roman Catholic faith. Of course, it's a very progressive Pope Francis kind of, you know, global climate change and all kind of progressive stuff that goes with it.
Economic
but nobody
equality.
Is worried mm-hmm. about conflating church and state these days. I mean, even the Americans United for Separation of Church and State, which used to be a fairly Baptist and libertarian organization, is now, they're much more worried about proponents of religious freedom. Religious freedom is really a cover for getting religion back in. Meanwhile, President Biden is meeting with the Pope. Right. And that's just great because they agree on climate. Mm-hmm. Oh, well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we could spend weeks talking about Francis. For me, he's very interesting as a Jesuit coming. When I see some of the things he says theologically, it certainly makes sense to me, having spent so much time reading and thinking about Karl Rahner, but for others, people who might have preferred, you know, Benedict and what was thought to be more of a Catholic's Catholic, that it seems like it's coming out of left field. But it's you have these different strands and completely different, oddly enough, as odd as this may sound, very different traditions within Roman Catholicism, which could be confusing for folks. But backing up, I want to get to some intersections with Presbyterianism in the early 20th century. But before that, I even want to ask just if we can put ourselves in the setting of 1960 for people my age and younger who might not understand, you know, what life was like with the prospect. There had been a major candidate before, a Roman Catholic candidate for president, but John F. Kennedy was the first to actually be elected, the first Roman Catholic president. What were people's fears that he was going to initially receive his orders from the Pope and this hierarchical alien element was going to overtake the country? Is that what Protestants thought of? And you'd made comments earlier that your Baptist parents didn't seem to have the same fears. It wasn't a major problem for them, was it?
Yeah, I mean, it was totemic, I think, for a lot of Protestants in America that Rome represented something alien. And it's probably comparable, and I hope this doesn't trivialize anything on either side, but it's the way it's totemic for people with masks, whether you wear or don't wear.
Sure.
I mean, so there's just a symbolic character to Rome. And I mean, I guess maybe some of my old background surfaced, my few years of living before Vatican II, but we had a Cardinal Muller here on campus last week to give a talk. And the introduction emphasized his eminence and tried to explain why people would bow to him and why he dressed the way he did. And that kind of got my Protestant dander up. And I saw some students going up to the cardinal who was sitting in the front row before he was speaking, and they were kneeling to him. And then after talking, they were crossing themselves. And Paul Blanchard, and I don't like Paul Blanchard and his anti-Catholicism. I really thought it was a number of cheap shots, but he does make the point that of how alien it looks to Americans to kneel for anyone. That's sort of what you do with a monarch.
Was he the one that made the comment about Jackie Kennedy? at the funeral.
Right, right.
Yeah, and then she kissed the bishop's hand, I believe it was, and they thought there was nothing more anti-American than doing that.
Right, and the hierarchy still holds on to the hierarchy in a way. I mean, I don't think they promote it the way they may have used to, but the attire, the clerical garb does point to that. The affect of Rome points to something that is not egalitarian, that's not democratic. It's not even aristocratic. It's kind of monarchical. And even though I'm a great admirer of the Netflix series, The Crown, and I've come to greatly appreciate constitutional monarchy, it just feels something foreign about that. And I think that's what people sensed. Plus, then in the 50s, you had a much more vigorous, much more numerous parochial school system. And the public school was the vehicle by which you were to assimilate immigrants into America the way you were to teach American ideals and civics lessons. And if Roman Catholics weren't a part of that, well, what does that mean about them? So there were just some cultural oddities, even though for the most part, especially in urban politics in America, say the first Roman Catholic presidential candidate nominated by a major party anyway, Al Smith, the New York governor in 1928, but he had come out of New York City politics. Tammany Hall, that whole infrastructure of Democratic politics in New York City. And there, in places like there, in Boston and Philadelphia and Chicago and Baltimore, I mean, the lifeblood of the city politics were Roman Catholics. And I don't think the Protestants who lived in those cities thought that, oh no, we're living in maybe Dublin now or something. They kind of got along with it in a way, but when it got to national level, that's when it became more alarming.
Yeah, they didn't have as many issues with even governors that they did with the potential president. One thing that I thought was really enlightening for me, perhaps this is maybe a very obvious point for you, but I'm glad of your treatment of this in the book, is we tend to think of things as Protestants and as Americans, at least listeners of this program, I presume, and wondering, you know, why we would have a problem with a Roman Catholic president. But Roman Catholics, at least in the hierarchy, the higher-ups, the Pope, and historically speaking, they had just as much, if not more, problems with Americanism as Protestant Americans might have had with a Roman Catholic governing them.
Right. So there were debates in the 19th century among the bishops. It kind of broke down. Irish Catholic were pro-America. German American bishops, at least some of the most vociferous that were anti-Americanists, were German American in background. And eventually it percolates up to the Vatican. And one of the things that I didn't really fathom until I wrote this book and did more reading in Roman Catholic history was, you know, from the Vatican's perspective, they're, so much of their political history was tied up in European politics, European geopolitics, getting the Austrians to bail us out now, getting the French to get out of here now, making alliances with Spain, all these different Roman Catholic powers. The papacy needed to maneuver in that universe. So from that perspective in the 19th century and even 18th, you're looking at America and you're saying, what? It's a colonial society. It's largely British. It's Protestant. Why do we care?
Right.
And sure, we'll try to help out whatever Roman Catholics are there, but there aren't many. There are only 30,000 out of 3 million in 1790, the first census, I think. So it's not a big player. But in the Cold War era, and with the United States emerging as this major player in the free world, Europe is really in disarray,
And anti-communism, right?
and the Vatican is anti-communist. It's not anti-communist in the same way that Americans are necessarily, but still, at that point, the Vatican has to take America much more seriously. If you're going to do business in global politics, you got to come to terms with America. So that's another reason. That's not in any way, I'm not suggesting that that's kind of the background for what happens at Vatican II and the bishops recognizing religious freedom there. But it's more just the sense that the American church becomes a much bigger player after World War II, because now they are the ones who are in this major power. And if the bishop, if the Pope and the Vatican officials are going to get any kind of insight into America, they're going to need to deal with the American bishops as well.
Right.
So, and this is, you know, obviously this becomes true as well when it comes to wealth and the capacity that American Catholics have to give money for church causes, whether in the United States or elsewhere. So you just see this enormous shift. But back to the problem with Americanism, it seemed to go against the idea, especially what's crucial in Murray's formulation of the issue, the idea that error has no rights.
Mm-hmm.
This was a position that Protestants also had. Wherever you have a religious establishment, the Puritans were not interested in giving rights to Quakers or Baptists, for instance. That's why Roger Williams had to leave. That's why Anne Hutchinson had to leave the colony. So the idea that your true freedom is to do the right thing, is the freedom to do the right thing. And if you use freedom to do the wrong thing, to believe the wrong thing, to commit sin, well, then we can't give freedom for that. And it's an understandable position. It's a position that a lot of Protestants would largely agree with, even though the error and the correct positions would be different for Protestants and Roman Catholics. But it takes until the 1960s for Rome finally to embrace or to get around the idea that error actually can have rights, that we can have freedom for wrong religious views, even freedom for less than perfect marriage arrangements, et cetera. Not to say that the church is recognizing Protestant marriages or something, but still, in those societies where there are Roman Catholics, you know, we can recognize the validity of those marriages, et cetera, et cetera. So it goes across the board like that, but it does take, you know, it takes Rome until the 1960s, whereas for Protestants, for instance, at the time of the American founding, they've come around to it by then. But even before that, at different iterations in British history in the 18th century, you can see gradual recognition of more rights for Christians who are outside the church. And in England, say, for instance, with the ending of the Test Act for Catholics, 1829 or 28, somewhere in there, Roman Catholics finally have the right to vote. If they qualify on the other grounds of property and whatnot, they can run for office, they can go to university, et cetera. So it's not until the 19th century, say, that the English church catches up with this. But again, it's another 140 years for the Roman Catholic Church to overcome this basic idea that, yes, we can grant rights for people to commit error.
Sure. Was there also suspicion from the Vatican that Americanism was bound up with, or maybe even the product of modernism? I mean, there seemed to be
right.
suspicion of the American politics or the American experiment for two reasons. Either it's too religiously Protestant, or it's not religious at all, and it's like bound up with the French Revolution and just utterly, you know, vacuous void of any righteousness whatsoever. And so it's interesting to me to see the intersection of this in 1910, for example, with the anti-modernist oath, which was issued, right, if I get my popes correct, by Leo XIII. And
it's a Pope Pius X.
Pius the Tenth, but then maybe later Leo had some other involvement later on. But then in 1917, there was a code of canon law or something that was issued where there was a prohibition, or at least a requirement that the theology of Thomas Aquinas and et cetera would be taught in all the Catholic institutions and whatnot. So there's great suspicion about modernism and the employment of the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas to answer that problem. And so to look at American ideals and whatnot, and if they are seen as a product of modernism, that could add just almost insuperable, obstacles to any approval of Roman Catholic hierarchy of Catholics being involved in this type of a government.
Right. And so it's curious in a good way that you bring up the French Revolution, which again, through the lens of European politics in the 18th and 19th centuries, the Vatican, I mean, is literally assaulted by the French with Napoleon, say, invading Italy in the 1790s. But that's one way of saying, again, that the Vatican's perspective on the world is through European affairs. So here you have the French embracing republicanism, and you have Americans embracing republicanism. Well, it must be the same. But I would argue they are different. The French philosophical background, such as I know it, is different from the British one to which the founders appealed. But it's also, if you throw into the mix there, and kind of, you can maybe Protestants may be able to, and Reformed Protestants in particular may be able to sympathize with this, with when you think about the anti-revolutionary party that Kuyper founds in the late 19th century in the Netherlands. He also saw the revolution in very black and white categories. So that's why he wanted to be an anti-revolutionary party. But he also said really, really good things about the American Revolution and the American system of government. So, you know, when you brought up modernism then with the condemnation in 1907, I think was the encyclical, 1910 was the oath.
Yeah.
And at that point, the Vatican does lump Americanism in with modernism, even though modernism is more a philosophical tradition. And but they do somehow work the political philosophy behind Americanism into that notion. But it is, again, instructive for those of in our circles of the OPC when Machen's writing against modernism, say, in the 20s, obviously, there are good reasons to be concerned about modernism and these philosophical developments.
Yeah.
And so, again, there's not as much, there's a real difference about what the correct stuff is, but there's also a similarity in some ways of viewing what the threats are, whether it's the French Revolution, whether it's certain philosophical developments. So Protestants are also anti-modernist, the way Machen was, even though he's much more on board with the American founding,
sure,
than Rome would be at that point.
You know, I've been tossing around this parallel inquiry, this investigation. I guess it's a thesis in the making, probably for the last 10 years or so. So I don't know what you think of this, but we do see some at least superficial parallels between American Presbyterianism and Roman Catholicism. Looking at the early 20th century, you find the modernist fundamentalist debate in Presbyterianism. And then over the years, eventually you see what happens with the mainline trying to combat modernism, but they seem to do so by embracing, at least to some degree, the theology of Karl Barth, or a theology that's amenable to it. And that is given birth, or at least is revealed in the Confession of 1967. But in Catholicism, you have this anti-modernist oath in 1910, and then Catholicism trying to combat modernism. But what seems to happen in almost, the same amount of time, you end up with Vatican II and all of its declarations, which in many ways is seen to be the victory of Karl Rahner, or at least people like him.
Right.
One theologian or historian called him the Holy Ghost writer of Vatican II. So although he was on the censored list prior to the council, he ends up being seen as, perhaps one of the most influential Catholics coming out of it. There are others, but
right,
it's interesting to see these parallels and two ways in which, American Presbyterianism can't hold a candle to Catholicism in terms of numbers, but just to see two, you know, large theological bodies trying to wrestle with modernism in the ways that they do so, and the confessions or at least statements that come out as a result, is quite intriguing to me.
Right. No, I think that's a useful parallel. And I mean, it made me, I chuckled in part because the way the American church tells a story about Vatican II, they really feature the contribution of John Courtney Murray.
Yes, and I wanted to speak
and
about
he's
him.
Sort of like he's the big guy. But in the 50s, he was actually told by the Jesuits to stop writing about church and state. So it's, I mean, somebody probably has written a book about this, but the way in which the people who were suspect prevailed at Vatican II would be a really curious
fascinating
to look at it.
Right. Yeah, he's an interesting figure. And, to connect some dots here, I know I'm bouncing around, but this is a fun conversation. This is how real conversations unfold, right?
Right.
So we're not scripted here at Christ the Center. So, you could, from one perspective, on a superficial level, look at John F. Kennedy as, the great hero of this American story. He's the first Roman Catholic president, and he makes it fine and cool for Roman Catholics now to be Americans and all of that. But the people at the time were highly suspect. They John F. Kennedy, but certainly Jackie Kennedy and others, his closest friends, they couldn't even understand why people might have a problem with him being president because he was such a bad Catholic. Like, they were, why would this ever be a problem? Like, he's a Catholic, yeah, but how is that ever going to influence his political views? But it wasn't until, I believe, December after the election, right, where Time magazine didn't feature Kennedy on the front right. regarding his Roman Catholicism, but featured John Courtney Murray, this historian, this theologian, social thinker, speaking about church and state and Catholic thought now developing along these lines. How are we to understand that, in your opinion, from an historical theological perspective? What's going on with Catholicism at this point where he, at least is getting public recognition and attribution from Americans, but he, much like Rahner, I don't think he was to the degree censored by anyone, but he was definitely told to shut up. And then becomes one of the paratii, the experts at the council, and then following
right.
the council, lauded by many as one of its champions.
Right, but even there, the first two or three sessions of the council, there was still a kind of a ban on whether Murray could be invited or not, and bishops, American bishops, really had to go mm-hmm. to bat for him. So I assume that Murray came on the radar of Time magazine for that cover, partly because of developments in the 50s. And he was something of a newsworthy character before the church or his superiors told him to stop writing about this. He was good friends, as I understand it, with Reinhold Niebuhr, who was also a prominent public intellectual and Protestant in that era. But Murray, for whatever reason, drew the straw to respond to the anti-Catholicism of Paul Blanchard in his best-selling book of 1949, American Freedom and Catholic Power, which painted the church in really lurid categories, much of it because the church has such a long history and so many documents and encyclicals, you could pick all sorts of things to show how they were running up against American political norms. That would be easy to do, but whether, that's the fairest way to present the most recent developments in the church is another question. So Murray began to write about this. He did get in some trouble, but the Kennedy campaign did consult with Murray briefly about church and state matters. And I think it was mainly just a phone conversation from the books that I've read about it. So it wasn't as if Murray was a big figure for the Kennedy folks, Kennedy campaign. But I encourage readers, if it's not behind a paywall, I mean, listeners, if it's not behind a paywall, to go read the story that the Time did about Murray. It's a very thoughtful piece about of trying to harmonize Roman Catholicism with American political norms. And this is something that it seems to me even Presbyterians have to do. If we went on the basis of, say, what Presbyterians expected in England in the 16th century or in Scotland in the 17th century, Covenanters being a prime example of this, and Covenanters were really prominent in Scottish politics in the 17th century, people would be worried about us running for office. But so every Christian tradition has to come to terms with its cultural environment, its political system in some way, and Roman Catholics are doing it in ways differently from Protestants, obviously, but in ways also that are kind of useful to compare and gain a better perspective. So Murray is really useful for that. He prevails in some ways in one of the sessions of the council, especially when it comes to religious freedom.
Yeah.
And quite, tragically, maybe is too strong because I think he was in his 60s, which is relatively young these days. He says, as he's in his 60s himself, but he dies in 1967. Murray does of a heart attack, which was beginning to flare up even during the council. So that would mean he wasn't around to comment on some of the post-Vatican II developments. And even, it would have been interesting to see if he had lived long enough to interact with John Paul II at all, how that might have gone. But he's the really dominant theological force for American Catholics down to even, well, certainly the 90s and the aughts. George Weigel, who was also here on campus last week with the Cardinal, he's a big John Courtney Murray guy.
Yeah.
And a lot of the stuff that Weigel's written about American Catholics draws heavily on Murray. And that tradition was kept alive in big ways at First Things magazine with Newhouse and later.
Now, continue in this line of thought on John Courtney Murray and the changing shifts or the views of Vatican upon Americanism. You comment in the book, particularly in chapter 3, that after President Kennedy died, there started to be an increased frequency of papal pronouncements about international relations. But this really was only a small part of the blending of church teaching and American ideals. But with a lot of these encyclicals, the Vatican seemed to embrace modern conceptions about human rights and human dignity that would actually align the concerns of the church in the wider world. And Pope John the 23rd, who was the one who initially called the council, he died during the council, and then I believe it was Paul the 6th who finished it. But John the 23rd linked rights to human dignity, and he set the agenda for the ecumenical council to come. And then it was the church that went on this course of aggiornamento. Got some materials on Vatican II if people want to learn more about that. How did that, inform, or at least change the context for John Courtney Murray to make maybe his ideas a little bit more plausible than they would have been in the early 50s, for example?
Right.
Was there a shift?
It certainly did take the pedal or the pressure off, the foot on the pedal, the brake pedal, say, to use that metaphor. But no one saw it coming. I mean, no one saw even John the 23rd being appointed pope. He was, from the material I've read, people seem to have thought he would have a short papacy. This was kind of an interim position. His health wasn't great.
No.
So, and he had a really common man's background.
Yeah.
So he was sort of out of the internecine fighting of Italian families over the Vatican. So this was just kind of an interlude, but all of a sudden out of nowhere, because the Pope has the kind of power a Pope has, he could call this Vatican Council. And so that really did change the configuration for Murray, but also for the American church as well.
Yeah.
So, a lot of the archbishops in the big cities in America could rule, I'm putting scare quotes up because I don't want to overdo it, but they could rule with a pretty heavy hand in those dioceses and parishes. And you can read stories about how rich and full Roman Catholic life was in the ghetto. And it's not as if the Archbishop was controlling everything, but it was a big part of people's lives living in those big urban centers. So it's not as if those archbishops wanted necessarily to democratize the church or something, but they also recognized that Roman Catholics could have achieve a lot of stature and do a lot with their communions in America that wasn't possible in other, say, Protestant or secular countries. So in that sense, I think they were on Murray's side. And one of the things that's going on at this period as well with the 1950s and 1960s is that there's just a general affluence of American society, including Roman Catholics, who are increasingly going to college and university for education, increasingly leaving the ghettos and moving to the suburbs as part of the post-World War II boom. And so the kind of canopy of American Catholic life that had existed in those large urban areas is beginning to break down, and the church is becoming much more suburban. And that has an unintended consequences for this idea of adapting to the modern world, across the board, not just in America, but the adaptation to the modern world doesn't go as smoothly as some might have thought it would or hoped it would, because these other forces are at play beyond simply relations between church and state.
Sure. And you also comment that once Vatican II concludes, that it really signaled, you're looking back as an historian trying to understand these big shifts, but it really was at that time that it seemed as if now American Catholics, and especially the theologically and politically aware, now were free to come out from under a cloud of suspicion. I'm curious about that and the timing of it because, that's 67. You certainly have a conservative movement that has been occurring, many years before that. So, which is led in many ways by Roman Catholics. I'm curious how these two things fit in terms of what's going on with Roman Catholic public intellectuals in America, and then their international, I guess, reception, or I sh maybe I should just say. The Vatican's comfortability with them maybe 10 or
Right.
15 years later.
That's a really good question. And whenever someone answers that way, it means they don't have the answer. But no, but I think my sense is that the American public intellectuals, the American Catholic public intellectuals, were not regarded seriously even after Vatican II by European either bishops or intellectuals, because a lot of the American Catholic intellectuals were not at universities themselves, and that's kind of a gives you a standing in the world. They were magazine writers, editors, maybe sometimes even political hacks working for political organizations or campaigns. But I mean, where this does go, and it does provide something of an answer. So, I mean, the Buckley Kirk kind of movement is responsible partly for having a figure like Barry Goldwater nominated in 1964, who fails miserably in that contest. But the way the story goes is that same movement eventually came, it picked Ronald Reagan as early as 76 and then 1980. And so you see the fruition of the conservative movement play out with Ronald Reagan. And you could argue that at that point, the political Republican move conservative world is beginning to cast more attention to the Protestants out there. Moral majority starts in 1979. And you have this new evangelical electoral category that is part of the Republican strategy. And it turned out to be a fairly smart one, even though it may not be the smartest for evangelicalism. So maybe Protestants, excuse me, Roman Catholics begin to decline in some ways. And that's where I, in the story that I try to tell, that's where people like Newhouse and Weigel begin to pick up, say, the Roman Catholic piece of the older conservative movement and give it more theological heft. And it's, and that's a period when John Paul II is Pope. And this is a period when this man, George Weigel, who's a close friend of Newhouse, along with some other people who are writing for First Things and other outlets and are very much pro John Courtney Murray types, Weigel gets a major coup to write a biography of John Paul II. It's a big biography. And Weigel has continued to write about John Paul II after the Pope's death. But so that there is a sense in which the Vatican does recognize these American intellectuals. And Weigel has a PhD, I'm pretty sure, I can't remember where or when, in international relations, I believe, and I should know that. But he never really had a university appointment. He was a think tank guy, much more so.
I see.
And if you want to see how those intellectuals have been regarded, if gaining the rights to a Pope's biography is an indication, there is one. Now, again, there are plenty of Roman Catholics on the left and European Roman Catholics who are suspicious of that biography and suspicious of Weigel and Newhouse's agenda. But, I mean, they would have audiences with the Pope. The way that conservatism prevailed in American politics with Reagan, I think, did give them a higher standing, even with some European bishops, not merely at the Vatican, but outside the Vatican as well. So, you know, there's more of an international character to this American Catholic conservatism than meets the eye, even though it may only be a minority position in the European world. It still seems pretty significant.
Mm. I don't know if Frank Meyer, for example, is a Roman Catholic, but he comes up in
he converted at the end of his life. Yeah.
So anyway, that makes sense. Then him as a representative. You bring up this interesting quote in a chapter that you titled "The Limits of Americanism," which is followed by, and I'll get to my question, but it's followed by chapters titled "Americanism Revived" and then "American Redux," which is interesting how you trace the conservative movement along these lines. But at least in chapter 6, there of course was so much strife in the United States in the 1960s. In many ways, we're seeing, you know, 60 years later, or at least in the summer of 2020, for a variety of reasons, kind of like a repetition of a lot of the strife that was going on in the 60s.
Right, right.
But many people thought that strife was compromising American ideals. But according to Frank Myers in his book, Nixon Agonistes, the United States problem was not the Constitution or its political traditions, but the destruction of our Constitution and our tradition. And then you comment that thinkers such as Wills and Bozell sensed that the turmoil of the 1960s from race to sex was not an aberration, but a consequence of United States political ideals. I thought that was just tremendously insightful and for me, very prescient, since we're seeing kind of, I believe it was Mark Twain, but I know every quote either gets attributed to Mark Twain or Abraham Lincoln. But it's not as if history repeats itself, but it certainly rhymes, and we're seeing that, I think, today in many ways.
Right. Well, I mean, this goes in some ways back to the categories that that Murray was trying to fashion, and this is why the book by John McGreevy that I mentioned earlier, I think. We were recording then about American freedom and American Catholicism, or American Catholicism and freedom, or something like that, is a meditation, a historical scrutiny of American Catholics' understandings of liberty. But Murray really emphasized ordered liberty. And this is something that circles in which I've worked for the last 20 years or so, these conservatives have emphasized ordered liberty. So it's not just license. They're always afraid of license. And that's what Wills and Bozell were afraid of. And that's why I think Newhouse thought the Catholic moment in America was one where Roman Catholics would be able to supply the order that liberty needed to avoid license. And, you know, I think on paper, you can see that playing out a certain way and making a certain amount of sense. But what that chapter was, I've given parts of that chapter as papers at some conferences, and I really admire Gary Wills. I think he's the smartest of the bunch of the intellectuals that I study in this, even though he kind of went off the radar, both for Roman Catholics and for conservatives. So but I do have a picture of him on my door. He's just such a smart guy. His book on encyclicals in 1963 was just flat out brilliant, like so much of his writing. But I think what Wills and Bozell were experiencing in the 60s was what, say, the integralists today, people like Patrick Deneen, who wrote a book, Why Liberalism Failed, he's a scholar at Notre Dame, or Adrian Vermeule, who teaches law at Harvard, who's a proponent of integralism, the idea that church and state should cooperate in some way. I think Bozell and Wills were seeing the limits of the American liberal tradition, unless you had something else there to rein it in. And the 60s was beginning to fray, and it didn't look like liberals had the capacity to keep it from fraying. And I do think that's been one of the difficulties of our lifetime, is the degree to which you can keep liberalism. But it seems to me, and now I'm going to get political in a way, or and this is just my view, but it seems to me it'd be really hard for a liberal to be intolerant, because tolerance and liberalism go together, because freedom is tolerant. But you also have to be intolerant at the limits. In order to protect freedom, you have to sort of create some boundaries for it. And it just seems to me we're really having trouble recognizing that there are limits to freedom. So that's what Roman Catholics seemingly have observed. Of course, there have been American Protestants who have recognized that as well and come at it from a different direction, but they haven't been as prominent in the political or cultural sectors as Roman Catholics have been since 1970 or so.
Well, you know, in your conclusion, I think you bring many of these themes and strands together in an interesting way. And I appreciate your take. I was commenting to my wife, which of course you know, Erica, and just on your particular style, which I very much appreciate. But I'm so used to often reading, in addition to theological books, I often read, you know, business books and other things like that. It's a nagging interest I have from a previous life. And those are very formulaic in terms of an introduction and a conclusion and, you know, bullet points. And they, you know, basically I can... When I read books in that style, and I read many for Christ the Center, I can digest the book. I could probably read a 300-page book and get enough that I need to know for it for an interview in about half an hour. Your book is not that way, not because it's opaque and not because it's unclear. It is clear, and it is in many ways transparent, but it demands more of me, which I appreciate, and I thank you for your style in writing.
You're hurting sales.
I'm trying to help sales, okay. Because it
all
is
right.
A,
all right.
My point is it's a more thoughtful book, and it demands something of the reader to be invested in order to get the true value out of it. And I think that there's a great amount here to be had. There's a lot of gold in this book, but here's my point. Anyway, I want you to expand
Thank
on this
you.
Thesis.
Thank you, by
well,
the way.
You're thanks. Welcome. that's not meant to be a backhanded compliment
no,
at all.
No, that's fine.
It's genuine.
No,
it's genuine.
I appreciate to hear that. Thanks.
So that's a preface to this question, okay? Here's your thesis, but I would love for you to explain and elaborate this, you know, in brevity or whatever, to whatever degree you would like, to the listeners. Because in many ways, neo-Americanists endeavored really to ground the eternal truths of their faith in the concrete realities of U.S. domestic and foreign policy. But you write here on page 227, in an important sense, they were merely heeding Vatican II's call for a modern faith. I was wondering if you could comment on that and what significance you find in that Vatican II's call And so that's extremely interesting to me because as Vatican II was pronounced, it also came with a proviso that every locale, you know, the bishops in each location needed to take the declarations, constitutions, all the documents from Vatican II and apply them to their local context. And again, I'm coming at this from a theological perspective. I'm not saying you're not, but what I've been lacking in many ways is an understanding and a really thoughtful consideration of the political dimensions to this. I'm curious about the, you know, Vatican II's call for a modern faith and how that might intersect, I've used that word too many times, with a neo-Americanist impetus in a way to try to ground their faith in concrete actions, policies, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, one example that comes to mind, I'm teaching a course on post-Cold War America now, but George Bush II, or 43, started the office of, in some ways it was a continuation of something President Clinton had started, but faith-based initiatives. Right. And one of the figures, people he appointed in that was John DeLulio, a sociologist at University of Pennsylvania with a Roman Catholic, you know, some awareness of social teaching in view. And it does seem that the intellectual energy of a lot of Republican administrations has come from Roman Catholics who have been schooled in philosophy, political theory, church teaching. It's been a little bit wide. I mean, I think the nature of a Roman Catholic education is oftentimes broader than a public school curriculum or a university or college where, you know, you basically take a couple courses in these columns and then that's your general ed and you go on. And that more, a little bit more comprehensive view has enabled, I think, those scholars to hone skills, even say thinking of the Supreme Court right now, made up of five Roman Catholic justices, majority on the Supreme Court, and the legal traditions of the Roman Church are such that it, I think, again, it facilitates that sort of endeavor. And you know, so again, that's a kind of fruition of the neo-Americanist or Americanist project, that they've been able to situate themselves well in these institutions in America, not all of which created by Roman Catholics. And even the ones that are created by Roman Catholics still have to observe certain procedures, policies, laws in order to grant degrees, et cetera. And so they've been able, whether it's thrive or flourish, depends on your perspective, but they've been able to do well. But on the flip side of it, though, and this is kind of a contemporary tension that's arisen since, that I get into in the last chapter in the conclusion somewhat, but there are Roman Catholics still, and there is a strong sense of Americanism being hostile to Roman Catholicism, but both by some American Catholics on the left or on the far integralist right. And so they don't like the American system. They don't like Lockean political theory, for instance, among other aspects of it. And what's odd about that is that if Vatican II is correct, and for Roman Catholics, you would have to assume that it is, well, if Pope Francis can kind of go along with what churches in South America are doing and kind of baptize that and say the church needs to work with those local traditions, even thinking about ways of ordaining men who are married to certain kinds of roles as deacons or something. I think that was one of the proposals that came up at one of the synods. Why can't the church work along with the American system in some way? But if you believe that America is a great source of evil in the world, and I'm watching right now for this another course I'm teaching here about 1968 and the revolutions, you brought up comparing 2020 to what went on earlier, you know, America became a watchword for tyranny and imperialism and colonialism during the Vietnam War for people on the left in Europe and other places, and radicals around the world, even. And that has not gone away. People still think about America that way. I mean, America does have a large presence in the world, a large, you know, outsized to its people in the world. And America hasn't used that power well. So if you are suspicious of American power and you think that a lot of the idealism that Americans have is a lot of smoke and mirrors for other kinds of political gains, then it's, you know, then you can say, well, the church shouldn't embrace America because America is a source of evil. And to go local in that setting, in a Vatican II way, is to go local with something that is wicked. And there's that dimension to Catholic intellectual life right now that's more European than American, but it's there in parts and sectors of the American university systems, especially, and certain bishops here and there. So it's not as if the church, in a way, has ever really come to terms with Americanism, although I would say, in general, the bishops have. I mean, if you look at, as I do at toward the end of the book, this, which I believe began in 2012, the Fortnight for Freedom, that the U.S. Conference of Bishops started 2 weeks before July 4th, they were celebrating certain saints and martyrs caused to the cause of freedom. Among them, Thomas More, who, you know, to try to weave him into a pro-American liberty narrative that for a long time was largely a Protestant narrative, to weave someone executed by Henry VIII, and a casualty of the English Reformation is an odd intellectual feat, but they do it. And the bishops have been very much about American liberty. Again, it partly was political to push back against President Obama and a number of the policies associated with healthcare during his administration. But still, it was very, very Americanist, you could say. So generally speaking, I would say Americanism has prevailed. But what America means to Roman Catholics and others is another question. And that really depends on whether you're on the left or the right.
Yeah. Well, we're living in an age, I think, right now where Americans don't know what America means. And there's great strife. I mean, you're right. You're at an institution where I receive development emails of a certain character that have a certain, and I appreciate them greatly.
Right.
But there's a battle for what is our founding? What is our shared mythology? You know, is it historically accurate? Even if it is that what it ought to be? I mean, that's, these are the battles we're fighting where there is no one Americanism at the moment. And that's part of the challenge, and we'll have to see. Historians will have to understand, you know, 50 years from now, what happened in 2020 and 2021 and what its relationship was to organized religion of various kinds. But anyway, this is a tremendous book. Everyone should take a look at this. If you have any interest, if anything we've discussed today has sparked your interest, there's so much more in this volume, American Catholic, The Politics of Faith During the Cold War, authored by our tremendous guest, our friend D.G. Hart today. Thanks, Daryl, for joining me. I really enjoyed the conversation. Hopefully we can pick back up in the future.
Great. It's always fun to talk, and it's great to be with you this time. It's a lot of fun to talk about this stuff. So
we'll have to do some film picks next time. I want to hear your latest. I just saw, and I've been recommending Denis Villeneuve films to you. I just saw Dune, which is, I thought, a masterpiece. But it's one of those odd ones. It's a tremendous actual film, but also, you know, of a blockbuster quality. So we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see how people receive it. But
I've seen mixed reviews.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. For various reasons. Anyway, I very much appreciate that. But for anyone who actually cares, one I have recommended to Daryl previously is Incendies. So not for the faint of heart, but that's a tremendous film by Mr. Villeneuve. Anyway, you can find many, many books by Dr. Hart. We'll link to many of them in our episode notes. And one over my shoulder, a tremendous volume, Defending the Faith, intellectual biography in many ways, of J. Gresham Machen. And you got to say Gresham. It's a shibboleth sibboleth. So we always know whenever I see Daryl on somebody else's program and they say Gresham, we know they're not one of us. And even sometimes you think they're one of us, but they're not. Get it right, folks. It's Gresham. Anyway, we're online at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs and publications and events. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so by sending us an email at mail@reformedforum.org. Thanks so much for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.